You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host for today, Joe Clement. The Old Mole is a radio zine that comes at you every Monday morning with news, reviews, interviews, commentary, and analysis and arts from our radically socialist, feminist, revolutionary unionist perspective. Today's show is going to start with Bill Resnick and Tara Hurst talking about drug decriminalization in Oregon, the challenges, the opportunities, and the lessons to draw from drug decriminalization campaigns elsewhere. Today is the 117th anniversary of the Industrial Workers of the World being founded, so we're going to have a review of the 1979 documentary Wobblies, which was remastered and re-released earlier this year and put in the National Film Registry as a historic film. I've asked a local Wobbly who was around at the release and who has a good understanding of IWW history to come and talk about the Industrial Workers of the World, how this film helps us or obscures how we remember them, and connecting that film to our understandings today. The Labor Notes Conference was held in Chicago a couple weekends ago, and I got to go. There were over 4,000 activists, organizers, educators, and artists of different kinds there who came together in what kind of felt like a Continental Congress of the working class to discuss how we can take back our unions, how we can build new unions, and how we can put the movement back in the labor movement. There was a great labor arts exchange that happened and a concert with several outstanding performances. I'm going to bring some of those performances to the airwaves this morning. I'm also going to share a clip from a panel discussion about class struggle unionism, the name of a new book by Joe Burns. You can listen to The Old Mole at kboo.fm/oldmole, where you'll find past shows and segments with links to additional material. To start off today's show, we're going to turn it over to Bill Resnick and Tara Hurst to discuss the challenges since the passage of Measure 110 a couple years ago, which decriminalized many of the quote-unquote harder drugs in Oregon. Bill?
Tara Hurst, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill.
Tara Hurst is director of the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance. It's working to ensure that Oregon's new law decriminalizing possession of small amounts of illicit drugs that was passed through ballot initiative by an emphatic 59% to 41% vote. Oregon became the first U.S. state and joins Portugal as the first nation on the planet to decriminalize small amounts and thus challenge the enormously destructive punitive drug control policy that relies on police and prison that's doing so much now and through the past on harming all of us. But there's lots of interests that have profited from the drug wars and have successfully created widespread fears, indeed more than fears, terrors and panics about illicit drugs. And while they can hardly support return to the police and mass incarceration system, they continue their critique in Oregon of its decriminalization law and implementation. The Oregonian newspaper, in its zeal to smear any public program except high school and college football, it's given a lot of coverage to the critics. Tara will start later in the interview to evaluate these critiques, but first, Tara, remind us of the law's provisions and the great virtues for this country and indeed every place on earth of decriminalization and treating drug use as a public health problem instead of police and prisons.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. So Measure 110 was really created in response to the addiction and overdose crisis. And it was also created, you know, to help address the suffering that we're all seeing on our streets by increasing access to critical services, including housing. Basically, it removes criminal penalties for possession of small amounts of drugs in favor of a more health-based and science-backed approach to substance use. So rather than labeling drug users as criminals, what Measure 110 does is it treats substance use as a public health issue that's really affecting all of us, right? From siblings to children to our teens, pregnant women, and grandparents. There isn't anybody who is untouched from this public health issue. And so at this point, people in our communities who've been seeking harm reduction and addiction recovery services will soon be able to access those services more quickly, closer to home, and by someone hopefully that can share their cultural background as well as language. So the people who lack health insurance or access to good health insurance really won't have to worry about trying to pay for these services, because Measure 110 ensures that these services are free. And, you know, ultimately, as the U.S. has been criminalizing drug use for over 50 years, it truly has proven that it's not only cruel and has eviscerated communities, but it's also really ineffective. And more people are incarcerated than ever before, and more people are addicted than ever before. So that doesn't show us that this is a system that has been working. Oregon ranks second in the nation for substance use disorder and 50th in access to services. And really, Measure 110 is a tool in the toolbox to try and create more access to services and really work towards making sure that we can destigmatize addiction and substance use so that more people will feel safe to come forward and ask for help, which is what they found in Portugal to be the case.
Let's go a little bit more deeply into the problems created for people of a drug arrest, and it gets on their record. And even if it's dismissed, and even if they get some treatment or are forced into it, even if they don't go to jail, which is so common, even for small amounts, particularly with harsh judges who think they're protecting their county or city.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me we have to really recognize how deeply hurtful it is to people who, many of them, in fact, were leading relatively ordinary lives before they wound up in the justice system, and especially people of color.
Yeah, I don't think people realize, like, just the amount of damage that a criminal record can create, and that it really does create lifelong barriers. So a record for even a misdemeanor drug charge can sometimes be an automatic barrier to getting a job, housing, qualifying for a credit card or student loan, and can also automatically disqualify people from being eligible for certain professional licenses. So those pieces are, you know, exactly what we all encourage and want to help support people to have access to while we're creating these meaningless these barriers that don't help anybody. They actually create a world where they're having to go deeper into debt, not be able to create any kind of generational wealth or support for their families and their communities, and aren't able to access the simple things that we all need to be able to survive and be successful. A good job, safe housing, and, you know, for folks who want to go to school, to be able to get a student loan. I don't think anybody wants to create those barriers for folks, and that's never been a motivator for someone to seek help either. You know, we've spent more than a half a century to arrest our way out of this health crisis, and it really has created harms that span generations. The disproportionate impact of drug war related policies and practices on communities of color, which is what you talked about, it really means that they've been most harmed by economic and employment disenfranchisement. And that we're seeing play out in our communities in a really devastating way. So being able to at least decriminalize small possession of drugs means that we are creating less barriers for people to access basic needs like housing and employment.
And it also, it seems to me, and it's shown in Portugal, It reduces the deaths from overdoses or suicide of people who feel they've become unproductive for their families. They're a burden on others. They're having trouble, in fact, breaking the habit. Even if they're able to hold the job and do quite well, they still, after an arrest, become, it's profoundly depressing.
Well, I think what's important is what you see with Portugal is that when their law went into effect, in a few years after, their overdose death rate went down significantly from the rest of the European Union's overdose rate. So what they were able to see is when we destigmatize, when we decriminalize substance use, and we provide a pathway to services, less people feel the shame and the harm of substance use, and they have access to get these services. Now, there is a difference, unfortunately, between Oregon and Portugal, a glaring difference, which is Portugal has a socialized healthcare system and we don't. So they have more services. That being said, we are investing $300 million, which is five times more than Oregon has ever invested in these non-Medicaid services like housing, peer supports, low barrier treatment services, and overdose prevention harm reduction services. When we invest that kind of money into these services with community-based providers who know what they're doing and know how to work with the population and their communities, we will also see these results, and we already have. We invested $30 million early. They were called Access to Care Grants, and the studies from OHA showed that 16,000 people were able to access services they wouldn't have been able to access if Measure 110 funds and Measure 110 had not been in place. So that's 16,000 people who were able to get whatever it was, the help that they needed in that moment, instead of having to, you know, either go hide back in the shadows or, you know, didn't have the tools to reverse an overdose death. These are all critical components of the law that people are not talking about in the media, and it's not being represented. They're focusing on a small amount of calls going into a hotline, when ultimately the hotline was never meant to be the only and sole access point for folks to be able to get support. We want to make sure that there's no wrong door to getting these services and that all the services are free to the person seeking them. That means that you can walk into any space and get help. It also means that we'll have a lot more outreach and peers out there working with folks on their timeline and letting them know that there's more support and help available, and when they're ready, or if they're ready at that moment, then they can start connecting them to housing and outpatient and sobering and detox centers. So, you know, this will take a lot of time. You can't take a starved system that is ranked 50th and think that you can infuse some money in and that, you know, that we'll all of a sudden be out of the crisis that we're in. But we're also not making the crisis worse, which is huge when you look at what the impact has been on providers through COVID. Many had to close shop. Many of them had to move to telehealth. There's a myriad of issues that faced our providers, and they're just starting to claw and dig their way out. And because we have these funds to support them doing that, they're able to see more people. And that's where that 16,000 number, I think, is so important for people to recognize that a lot of people are getting the help that they need right now through Measure 110, and that was only 10% of the funds. So we're about to see a $265 million investment spread across every county in Oregon, focused on those science-based, evidence-informed practices of housing, peer supports, harm reduction, overdose prevention, and low barrier treatments.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Tara Hurst, the director of the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance, that's working to ensure that Oregon's new law decriminalizing possession of small amounts of illicit drugs, that it's properly implemented. Tara worked with the Measure 11 campaign that fought for Measure 10 in Oregon. It passed by 59% to 41%. But in the excitement of the November 20th election that defeated Donald Trump, it didn't make the national headlines it deserved. But Measure 10, it's decriminalization of small amounts of drugs, including the hardest ones, and it's setting up county networks of helping services. That's enormously important. No U.S. state has ever attempted it. We just discussed the law's provisions and its virtues, but interests have profited from the former police and prison treatment of drug use. So these interests can hardly defend the former laws and practices. They're still attacking. The one that the treatment group programs are being set up and funded much too slowly. Another critique that the law didn't require people apprehended to attend sessions with the county program. And also been critiquing that Portugal, in fact, did that, Oregon didn't. We'll be talking to Tara about the virtues of non-coercion. And they're also critiquing that the hotline set up by county programs allegedly got few calls. Tara spoke to that earlier. So, Tara, it's been a year and a half, and a lot of money has already been sent to very troubled because of COVID and other reasons, programs that have been deeply wounded. Tell us about the slow rollout, though.
No, I think, we've been the ones out there probably most loudly critiquing the slow rollout because we see just how it impacts the folks on the ground not having access to the services that they need and the providers not being able to keep their doors open. And it's having real impacts on the ground. That being said, there was a delay. The money was supposed to be out in January, then February, and you can imagine March, April, May, and now the money is starting to come out. I think there's 10 to 16 counties that now have established networks and are being funded. And, we are cautiously optimistic that it will continue to roll out in a much quicker fashion. There was a lot of problems with the rollout. I will say that, like anything, there's always going to be challenges when you try something new and when you try to buck a system that has been pretty engrossed in status quo and maintaining, status quo outcomes. So this was a heavy lift, but it's also an important and critical lift, and we really need all of our bureaucracies, especially the health authority, to continue to treat this and definitely treat this as an emergency that it is, and that hasn't always been the case. I will say that this is an agency that has had to grapple with some of the biggest issues that we've been facing in the last 2 years, being the health authority with, COVID. And as it's been reported, Oregon's done pretty well with COVID, considering what other states have been through. So you have to keep all of that in mind. And when you commit to timelines and you commit to getting money out and you break those commitments over and over again, you lose trust with the public. And so I think that we're all working hard to try and make sure that these funds get out. And we're going to start seeing, we've already started seeing funds out and networks being established and created, and really important money going into community provider programs that are life-saving. So the rollout, people pushing back and critics, including us, I think that's all fair criticism. And I look forward to having some real conversations about how to make sure that it doesn't happen the next time and that we're able to do a much more equitable process next time. So that's kind of where we're at on the funds. We're looking forward to seeing the tri-counties get up and running, since that is where our heavy population center is, and see those providers in Multnomah County. There's 41 or 43 providers that will be getting funds to provide more services, and a lot of them are culturally specific providers, and this is something that we've never had. So this is exciting time, and people should feel hopeful more than anything else, I hope, at this point, to know that, due to advocacy, due to pushing and a lot of hard work, these funds are getting out there.
Yeah, I have a lot of sympathy for people in the public sphere, public workers of almost any agency. They're heavily critiqued when a program that they funded goes bad and it turns out to be a poor investment for the state. Now, it means they often bend over backwards to evaluate where the money is going and doing all the auditing. And that stuff takes time, especially when there are new programs being set up. And I know that the networks are being set up. So it's not so surprising that things go slowly, that's my sense. although they shouldn't promise so much, you know, success in, yeah, in funding programs when they really can't meet the deadlines. And they're always sitting in fear that the Oregonians is going to find one which was scamming the state.
Right.
As if scammers don't take billions and billions from our private corporations or bonders or the various people who prey on the economy. Tara, one last question. Portugal, in fact, requires in its law people who are apprehended possessing even small amounts of drugs. There's penalties for not going to the local county group or the locality, the people who are doing drug treatment and trying to control drugs. They're penalized for not meeting with the people and discussing not just the perils of drugs, but discussing the extent to which they're really using and whether they need treatments. Now, there's no demand that people go into a treatment program, but there is a demand in the law that they discuss whether, in fact, they may need one. My sense is that Portugal, people trust the health system and especially a lot of the social service systems much more than they do in the United States, where they have been linked up with the police power and incarceration and deep, deep penalties, even the child welfare system, which has its own deep problems. But tell us about the question of coercion.
Right, get ready to stretch. We're going to dance a little bit. Get limber, movement. This is the arts, y'all. This is what we do. This is not just singing. We're dancing. We're doing theater. We're doing it all. So please get ready. Do. I hear a beat coming.
Do 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 do.
This one's for that hard worker, that dues payer, negotiator. This one's for that educator, that activist standing up for peace, organizing, rallying up in the cities. With our colors on, unity is strong. We'll fight to the nitty gritty. Too hot? Call the union fireman. Too hot? Solidarity's a requirement. Too hot? Call our name, you know who we are. Too hot? We're a movement on a mission, break it down. We're union, hallelujah. We're union, hallelujah. We're union, hallelujah. The union's gonna give it to you. The union's gonna give it to you. The union's gonna give it to you. Time is now when we're smoking hot. Don't believe us, just one. Ah! Watch. Don't believe us, just 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 watch.
Hey, hey, hey,
home. Stop and wait a minute. We're at war and we plan to win it. Take a seat and sign them up, or we will not give up. Here from New York,
Hollywood, here in Detroit City.
With our colors on, unity is strong. And we'll fight to the nitty gritty. Too hot? Call the union fireman. Too hot? Solidarity's a requirement. Too hot? Yeah. Call our name, you know who we are. Too hot? We're a movement on a mission, break it down. We're a union, hallelujah. We're union, hallelujah. We're union, hallelujah. The union's gonna give it to you. The union's gonna give it to you.
Whew. Union's gonna give it to you. That was Lynn Marie Smith, the Motown Diva, performing Union Hallelujah at the Great Labor Arts Exchange at the Labor Notes Conference in Chicago just a couple weekends ago. It's going to be a hot labor summer. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Tara Hurst about drug decriminalization in Oregon. We had to cut that interview off a little short to make room for all the great content and music we're trying to pack into today's show. So if you go to kboo.fm/oldmole in the next few days, you'll be able to listen to several more minutes as they get into why coerced treatment plans will not work and the ways forward as far as how we can implement Measure 110, which decriminalized drugs a couple of years ago.
So today is the 117th anniversary of the founding of the Industrial Workers of the World in 1905, the Continental Congress of the Working Class. came together and agreed to form the Industrial Workers of the World. So today we're remembering some of that history. And if you go to the Clinton Street Theater, you may have noticed that at the beginning of May, they had shown a remastered and reissued version of a 1979 documentary about the Industrial Workers of the World called Wobblies. It's a very interesting film, and I have reached out to a local Wobbly, a longtime Portlander, Morgan Miller, to discuss this film. There's a lot to like about it, but you know, there's a lot worth questioning and even criticizing. Morgan, thanks for coming on The Old Mole today to talk about this.
Quite welcome, Joe.
So the documentary came out in 1979, and it was shown in Portland in the next year or so. Morgan, you were there when that came out. Could you say a little bit about what it felt like to see the movie then, what it seemed to mean for the audiences, and what the IWW itself was like in the early 80s?
I remember coming out of the film greatly disappointed. I knew a number of the people that were interviewed in the film who are now long dead. And these days, it's nicer to see these people as they were rather than in my memory. But we were all very disappointed because I think Melvin DeVos, a historian of the IWW, said it best, that it was like the historical conditions had changed. So an IWW was no longer needed. And that was pretty upsetting. I mean, the IWW was very tiny at the time and very poorly organized and probably should have been out of business, but it wasn't. It was still around. And a lot of the people interviewed were still active in it.
Now, we should probably just say a bit about what the documentary is like. You can find the old version on YouTube for free. And if you pay a little money, you can get access to the remastered version. It's a series of interviews and montages set to IWW classic music, often images from the IWW's propaganda wars, stickerettes, and other political cartoons, but also historical footage.
Newsreel.
And voiceover quotes, both of IWWs and representatives of the employing class. And there's quite a bit also on just the anti-IWW propaganda itself and the image of the bomb-throwing saboteur that was very rampant in American culture in the early 20th century. What do you think is worthwhile or at least neat about this documentary?
I think to the extent that they allowed people to speak for themselves is the best thing. So you hear old people that were in their 70s or 80s at the time talking about their own real experiences. And that's invaluable. And it gives a real humanness to history, and especially to a history that's quite often politicized by various currents when it's approached today.
Yeah, I really appreciated the just really kind of funny stories that these old timers, both men and women, had to tell. There were workers who worked out in the forests as timber beasts, they were called. There were garment factory workers. This movie came out in the late 70s, and so folks who were in their 80s and 90s were actually, you know, alive and of working age in the teens and 20s. And the fact that this was, you know, captured with relatively decent cameras and audio and then remastered, like, really brings that period of time to life in a way that we otherwise today don't get access to. All those people are dead. And the only thing that we have is documentaries and footage like they collect or the memory of folks who knew them. There is something also, though, kind of limiting about how we talk to these folks so far removed in time from the days of their stories. And it kind of gives the impression that the world that gave rise to the IWW is also long in the past. But as the IWW has been around for 117 years, so have all the conditions, the realities of capitalism and the wage system and the domination of workers by employers has existed that whole time. And that is possibly a shortcoming of this film, is that it lends itself to a certain kind of amnesia about the present moment.
I wouldn't say it's amnesia. I would say that it's a lack of a certain consciousness. I mean, the film is not class conscious.
Agreed. One of the main spokespersons in the film, Roger Baldwin, who was a member of the IWW, but was a lawyer by training, ended up being one of the founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, expresses his own anxieties about like not really fitting in terms of class and the class conscious project that the IWW was. And yet his voice occurs throughout the film.
He's the voice of the supposed politics of the IWW. You know, there are other people in there that could have been much better at it. Plus also, I mean, when you're putting together a film like this, that they pick the quotes that they find are the most important and then piece it together in the way that they find will tell the story that the filmmakers want to tell. I don't think that the filmmakers are especially class conscious.
I did appreciate, though, at least one very kind of intentional editing choice they made in putting in juxtaposition two different ideas about what sabotage meant, because this was a big deal in the early 20th century and was part of splits in the socialist movement as well as the IWW over sabotage as this like destructive, violent act versus some pretty commonsensical ideas about controlling our labor, controlling the pace of things, and having power in that way. I mean, there is this story about the origin of the word sabotage and the French word for the Dutch clog, the sabot, being thrown into the works to make the machine break, kind of like this rehashing of Luddism, or of, again, a certain idea of what Luddism and that movement was about, destroying the machines rather than organizing to take collective action with our labor power, meaning slowing down, controlling the pace of what we do, or even what it is that we are doing. And that this was one of the bigger threats of the IWW in terms of developing a labor politic that could actually bring capitalism to its knees.
It would have to be collective. And the problem with most forms of sabotage is that it's individualistic. The IWW tried to play off of fears of the IWW in order to win more concessions. And it was used as a threat and kind of an irrational threat to the bosses. And it wasn't well enacted. It wasn't well thought out. I hold a fairly heretical view on it. But if you put it into the context of the time, the iron workers were going around the Western United States blowing up projects that were built without iron worker control, or, you know, by non-union workers. And I mean, it was a very real threat in the United States to have your, you know, building or your bridge or whatever blown up. At the time, there were dozens of cases of it. So IWW said, oh, you know, this is working for the iron workers. We should take this up too. And then they just started, you know, without consulting with the membership, really started pushing this, a handful of members. It came out as a disaster for the IWW. There are concepts in that you can kind of telescopically, you know, go back in time and look at and say, yeah, this worked, you know, these are true, these are accurate, but they've always been true and accurate, you know, such as withdrawal of efficient labor, walkouts, things like that. But those have to be collective. And if you go back and you look at what's Casey Jones' Union Scab, you know, the threat is that the Wobblies, they put some iron on the railroad track and Casey Jones' back got a mighty crack or something like that.
Yeah, and even the one of the songs about sabotage, Tarara Bumbie, Joe Hill's version of it, is also wanting to ramp up this fear of actual destruction being exacted by individuals, by folks who are just throwing something in the works, which does depart from the idea of through our collective control of labor, we can make the bosses do what we want.
Yep.
Now, one thing that compelling about the film and is just compelling about the IWW's history is even though the union itself didn't take an official stance on the war, the way that the IWW engaged with anti-war organizing, do you think that could be a lesson for today's labor movement, that we have this vast war machine, a lot of our economy is actually bound up in it, and that these are an existential threat to humanity when you think of how the military is not only this violent apparatus, but is one of the largest contributors to climate change. What did you think of the way that they portrayed the IWW's war against war?
I thought that actually had improved with age. I remember when I first watched it, it was kind of, it seemed rather abstract. Of course, I was young at the time, and the Vietnam War had already been over. Emotionally, it didn't resonate with 20-year-old me. But when I looked at it this weekend, watched it this weekend, I found that it was much more compelling that the IWW saw that the class war continues, despite that we, the working class and the employing class, don't have things in common, have nothing in common. And that's how they tried to practice it. Now, this gets into very tricky things because, you know, you get to World War II and most everybody went along with the war. You know, if the employing class and the working class have nothing in common, what do we do in a situation like World War II, the Korean War, or today? You know, if you look at the Ukrainian war, you see, you know, the American left going along behind the Ukrainian government. But the Ukrainian government's also enacting very draconian anti-labor laws right now. It's once again, imperialist war is part of the class war and is used against the working class. The end.
I'm wondering whether you could go back and talk a bit more about what you think the class perspective or lack thereof is in the film, because it's about one of the most class conscious, class struggle oriented unions of American history. So how are they portraying this class struggle unionism without the class perspective itself?
Here is how I would perceive it. This is along the lines that Fred Thompson, who was the official historian of the IWW and the editor of the Industrial Worker newspaper for years, put it at the time, plus the historian Melvin Dubofsky, who wrote one of the definitive histories of the IWW called Who Shall Be All, is that if you go back to the Communist Manifesto and Value, Price, and Profit, which was the basis of the Industrial Workers of the World preamble, if you go look at that, world history is the history of class struggle. And the movie isn't based on saying this form of civilization, capitalism, hasn't existed this entire period, the 150, 200 years, whatever, that we're covering, and that capitalism is the same now as it's always been. So somehow capitalism was bad in 1905, and capitalists were bad. They were meanies. And that in 1905, it was needed, but they'd never say that it's needed now.
I am thinking of how there is arguably a new potential for a labor movement that is not hung up in a lot of these 20th century things that happened to the labor movement through the rise of collective bargaining. We have a lot of folks still going out for NLRB elections, but there is also a decided shift in how unions like the Amazon Labor Union look at the role of rank and file and of taking the relationships that we have with each other at work as the basis of our power, rather than existing unions leveraging laws and relationships with management and running slick but shallow campaigns to get enough votes to become the exclusive representative of workers in these processes that happen away from their lives as workers, but ultimately are governing or influencing them.
As a service rather than as an existence.
Right, rather than as an extension of the workers' own agency and the desire that a lot of us have to have not just a say in things, but to have control in our lives and in our workplaces. And I feel there's something happening now, you know, history repeating itself, where 117 years ago, we had, you know, an extremely low unionization rate. Unions weren't even legal. And there was, you know, this kind of undiscovered territory feeling about the reality of the working class in America, that rather than trying to bore within the existing unions, there is all of these industries and all of these workers who are in these new arrangements of exploitation and domination that are aching for change and are in a position to realize what they could do together. And that is, for me anyway, what has always been inspiring about the IWW, even if over the last 117 years, it has gotten smaller.
Right.
This has been Joe Clement and Morgan Miller talking about the re-released 1979 documentary about the industrial workers of the world, Wobblies. You can find the film by searching Wobblies Documentary 1979 on YouTube. The original version was uploaded years ago and is definitely watchable. The remastered and re-released version is also on YouTube, but for a fee. You can also find the original on DVD at the library. Thanks for coming on The Old Mole today to talk about it.
Quite welcome, Joe.
Okay, I wrote the song for a Jewish climate rally, and I rewrote it for Labor Notes. Any Jews in the crowd? Very well represented at a labor conference. Okay, so it's getting warmer across the whole planet, and the waters are rising, goddammit, and parts of the country will be under the sea, creating wars of destruction for our children to be. And the worst part is that we've known the whole time our leaders betrayed us for pennies, nickels, dimes, and all we've got now are statements that are vague. God, we found our pharaohs, now where are the plagues? And Mirvaln, Zeiber Leben, oh Mirvaln, Zeiber Leben, Mirvaln, Zeiber Leben, we will outlive them, we will survive. Meanwhile, your rent is still coming, and the landlord won't fix the stove or the plumbing. The hospitals will kill you if you can't pay, and the government will throw you in prison for the rest of your days. Our pharaohs will tell you all about sustainability and compromise. Please don't forget the civility. But the UN is saying we've got less than 20 years, and that change will require some billionaires' tears. And Mirvaln, Zeiber Leben, oh Mirvaln, Zeiber Leben, Mirvaln, Zeiber Leben, we will outlive them, we will survive. It's easy to get hopeless thinking about the situation. You know, the end of the days creates quite the complications. With lives being lost, wind knocking down the doors, it's worth remembering that we've seen horrors before. There's an old tale about some Jews caught by the Nazis. They're back against the wall, not a way out that they could see. The Jews were requested to dance before they were dead. Well, one stepped forward, and here's what he said. He said, Mir, Veln, Zeiber Leben. He said, Mir, Veln, Zeiber Leben. He said, Mir, Veln, Zeiber Leben. We will outlive them. We will survive. As the bombs getting dropped kill another few million, and the genocidal profiteers hoard dough by the billions, we'll step forward, stand up, we won't be afraid. We'll move forward proudly, we're courageous and brave. Yeah, we'll build out a union and sing out this chorus. We'll shut down their factories so they can't ignore us. No one to save us but you and me. Yeah, we'll fight and we'll strike until we part the sea. Yeah, we'll build out a union and sing out this chorus. We'll shut down their factories so they can't ignore us. No one to save us but you and me. I will fight and we'll strike until we part the sea. Mirvaln, Zeiber Leben, Mirvaln, Zeiber Leben, Mirvaln, Zeiber Leben, we will outlive them, we will survive. Solidarity forever. Yeah, we'll fight and strike and part the sea.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Ben Moss Horowitz singing Mirvaln, Zeiber Leben at the Great Labor Arts Exchange Concert at Labor Notes, which was in Chicago a couple weekends ago. I got to stay up late on a couple nights singing songs, either in a song circle or around a piano. There are amazing clips of some of those late night performances, which you can find on Twitter. You don't have to have an account to search by Google. Look for the hashtag LaborNotes2022, and you'll find hundreds of posts of pictures and stories. Before that song, though, I was talking with Morgan Miller about the 1979 documentary Wobblies, which was remastered and re-released earlier this year. You might have seen it or heard about it at the Clinton Street Theater on May 2nd. We had a critical conversation about the way that we remember labor history and what a class perspective means for the way that we appreciate the history of the labor movement, as well as understand the situation now and potential for the future. That is why I have chosen for the last segment today to share some audio that I collected from Labor Notes. Joe Burns talking about his new book, Class Struggle Unionism. He here in this very edited excerpt that I'm going to share is talking about the principles of class struggle unionism.
So I came to write Class Struggle Unionism because I said, well, let's look back at the classic labor theory and try and come up with what are some of the principles that they use. And when I look at labor history in the United States, the main divide within the labor movement was between class struggle unionism and bureaucratic business unionism. And they really can be defined looking at the employment transaction. The business unions typically had a pretty narrow view of what their role is as unions and what their role of what employment was. They basically see they can be summed up with the slogan, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. They see themselves going in fighting unreasonable employers and basically trying to negotiate a better wage and some better work conditions, which are all valid concerns, but they kind of ignore the fact that we live in such an unequal society that even if you have a strong union contract, employers are out of the employment transaction. That's how we get billionaires in society. So in contrast, the class struggle unionists have a different slogan. Labor creates all wealth. It's based on the idea that working people create everything of value in society through labor, and that through the employment transaction, everyone is forced to work from one employer or another. And when you go to work, you take the input from the employer, but it's not even the employer's, because other workers created, picked the coffee that you're brewing, you know, made the machines that you're using, but they pocket that. And that's how you get this unimaginable wealth in society. And it cannot be divorced from our trade unionism. It's not about money or rewarding them for work or whatever. It's about power to control the social surplus in society. And it's pretty simple, right? So when you look at that and how you look at the employment transaction, looking at it through the class struggle lens or the business unionist trend, everything flows from that simple distinction. But from that flow very different types of unionism. And you can say, well, what are the sort of key features of class struggle unionism? What do we believe in? Class struggle unionism see our unionism in every fight that we have as a fight, not just with a bad employer or a particular employer, but part of a struggle against an employing class. That there's a class of people, there are different classes in society. If you have to sell your labor in order to live in society, then you're working class, broadly defined. If you can live off the labor of others and live off your investment, then you're part of the employing class, or they used to call them, or well, still do, capitalist class or billionaire class, but you're a class of people who can live off the labor of others. And that creates the basis for sort of a conflict in society between these two groups of people. So, you know, traditionally the business unionists, you might know like some of the conservative building trades where they would just see their jobs as union officials as securing jobs for a narrow group of workers. They'll sell it out and we'll go build the Walmart. We can get the contract to build the Walmarts. We won't support living wage legislation for the workers, things like that. That's an extreme example, but we also see it where a lot of other situations, like the auto workers in the 1980s viewed the Japanese workers as their opponents rather than the employers. They embrace concepts like team concept where they get the workers to work harder rather than fighting. So, and they don't see their job as fighting sort of racism and sexism in society and taking on these broader class fights. But the second feature, and UE, the United Electrical Workers, talks about this as a form of unionism, which they call them and us unionism. And it's based on the idea that the working class and the employing class have mutually contradictory interests. And it should be a simple concept, right? You know, we're in bargaining, we want this, it's going to cost them money, they're against it, and they want that, they want money for their shareholders. But a lot of trade unionists over time adopt these philosophies where it's basically that we have an identity of interest and all we got to do is get to yes and find it. And they work to obscure it. We saw in the early 90s, you know, Jane Slaughter, the late Mike Parker, who passed away this year from Labor Notes, wrote the book on team concept because a lot of unions were falling for these labor management schemes where they would get the workers to work harder and harder and harder and engage in speed up. And that was their way that they were going to save the labor movement by keeping jobs. And it didn't work and it won't work. So them and us, we go looking for fights. They go looking to put fights out. That's kind of one fundamental difference. Another fundamental difference is class struggle unionists very much understand the importance of work rules and the struggle for the shop floor. Because based on our analysis of the employment transaction, our big fights aren't necessarily over the wage increase, although we always fight over that. But a lot of our big fights are over the work rules, right? Because employers understand if they can get you to work harder, if they can increase your rate of exploitation, that far exceeds a 2% or 3% increase. So if you look at the strikes that have been going on in production over the last number of years, a lot of those strikes are focusing on issues of like the length of the workday and things like that. What do we view the role of the government? A lot of the business unionists view the government as a sort of protector of trade unionism. And if we could just get them to more protect us better, you know, everything would be okay. Traditionally, class struggle unionists have been very suspicious about the role of government because they see that the government has a key role in defending this system of exploitation in society. So the government is not going to be neutral in labor disputes, and they never really are. The courts are not neutral. They side on the behalf of the employer. That's why you can write all the laws you want. You can pass a PRO Act. You can pass anything. But these judges are going to interpret it in the name of the class of which they serve, which is not the working class. You know, the final one to touch on in terms of our principles is class struggle unionists believe, as Karl Marx said, in that the working class wants to emancipate itself. So I think you will find that class struggle unionists, invariably, the ones I have known over the years, they have fought for worker participation in every decision. They have fought for democratic unions. They have struggled against corruption in their unions. Those are core principles that class struggle unionists uphold. So these set of ideas set us aside from the business unionists. But they also set us aside, and I'm going to really briefly touch on this, from a group of people that I call the labor liberals. In the late 1980s, there arose a class of folks within the labor movement, super progressive on all the issues. They talk the talk. They're really good. They want to organize. They want to do this. They want to do that. But they really had a different philosophy than the traditional class struggle unionists. These other folks, these labor liberals, they have a set of ideas, which is, yeah, we need to organize the working class. Yeah, we need to do this and that. We need progressive positions. All of that is welcome because the AFL in the 1980s suck. They were so bad on every issue. So the labor libs did a lot of good stuff in terms of moving along. But they abandoned a lot of the key parts of class struggle unionism. The fight for 15 is great and stuff, but what about their fight for the shop floor? And what about organizing the workers at the point of production? Those are key things. What about a critique of the labor bureaucracy? The labor establishment in this country, most unions, are not up for the task of reviving the labor movement. We have to have that conversation. AFL-CIO just had their convention. It's a tale of two cities. Here we have labor notes, 4,000 activists talking about how we're actually going to go out there and kick some ass. Then in Philadelphia, we got them talking about, we're going to organize, which they're not even going to do, 100,000 workers per year, which even if they do it, union density would go down because the labor force is increasing. So it's just this really narrow vision about what they have and what they're going to do. We saw it in the strike wave of last year. Production workers were fed up. They had some power. They had some ability to go out on strike after years of eating from employers. And production workers go out on strike. And what do they strike for? They have great aspirations. They want to strike for getting rid of two-tier systems. They want to strike to get rid of these inhumane work schedules. They want residuals for IATSE members in the industry, right? They have all these big ideas that they're striking for, but you can see when you follow the strike wave and what actually happened, that they'll start getting redefined by the business unionists to smaller and smaller goals and the tactics that they have and can use. You cannot have class struggle unionism if you don't have class struggle tactics. That means that we need a set of tactics willing to take on employers. We have to have a labor movement capable of violating injunctions and labor law. How do we deal with union treasuries? How do we protect them even if we're violating injunctions? What are the separate questions? But most importantly, what are the set of ideas we need in our head as a labor movement that leads us to believe that we can engage in the type of tactics which violate the alleged property rights of employers. That's a very different labor movement than what we have currently. And that's what we need to build, a trend within the labor movement that validates these ideas and this activity. And I think, you know, obviously labor notes and all these people getting together is like a key thing.
Three little birds sat on my window, and they told me I really should worry. COVID came and hasn't left, will it ever? But my vacation stayed at just 10 days. Maybe sometimes we work too hard, but it's not right. The more things stay the same, the more they need to change. Doesn't seem that strange. Boss, put that PTO on, 'cause we've been working too long. Let's get that union sign on. And please just add a raise, I need a job that pays my rent and gas and inflation. We'll get that PTO some way, somehow. Uber and Lyft drivers are lonely, and their bosses refuse to give health care. Staten Island workers won, but the work's not done. Jeffrey Bezos will know what's coming. Corporations own our houses, work lives, and data. The more things stay the same, the more they feel strange. Let's demand some change. Boss, put that PTO on, 'cause we've been working too long. Let's get that union sign on. And please just add a raise, I need a job that pays my rent and gas and inflation. We'll get that union some way, somehow. It's more than I can take, profits for profit's sake. Night shifts keeping us awake. We know that we are stronger when we work collectively to raise our voices and dismantle the system. We know we can win, boss, put that PTO on, 'cause we've been working too long. Let's get that union sign on. And please just add a raise, I need a job that pays my rent and gas and inflation. Boss, put that PTO on, 'cause we've been working too long. Let's get that union sign on. And please just add a raise, I need a job that pays my rent and gas and inflation. We'll make our voices heard some way, somehow.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks to Anita Matias for that amazing labor pop parody, Boss, Put That PTO On, to the tune of Put Your Records On by Corinne Bailey Ray. Before that, we heard Joe Burns talking about the principles of class struggle unionism, the name of his most recent book. There is a full panel on this at the Labor Notes conference that I recorded, and the audio for that will be available later this week on kboo.fm/oldmole. Thanks to Tara Hurst, who talked with Bill Resnick about drug decriminalization in Oregon and the path forward with realizing the promise of Measure 110 from a couple years ago. Thanks to Morgan Miller for coming on to talk about a problematic but nonetheless endearing documentary about the industrial workers of the world, Wobblies. Today is the 117th anniversary of the founding of the industrial workers and the world, and so we are trying to remember that union. It thanks to the Labor Notes staff, to the thousands of organizers, activists, educators, musicians, and other artists who came together a couple weekends ago to make something really special and to put the movement back in the labor movement. Learn more at labornotes.org. You can find links to things that we mentioned and to anything else that we find relevant in a few days when the show is posted to kboo.fm/oldmole. Tune in next week for more news, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Radical Perspective. For the Old Mole Variety Hour and for KBOO Portland, I'm Joe Clement.